Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to talk a little bit about despair and optimism, the future, and reading the signs of the times in Jesus's famous words from Matthew's Gospel. I don't know about you, but it certainly feels like we're living in an age of fatalism, of hopelessness, that people seem to be more negative about the way things are, both in their own nation and kind of globally, than ever before. And we wanted to spend a little bit of time thinking about some of the reasons for that, and then towards the end, what Christianity and the kind of Christian tradition might say into some of those kind of cultural shifts.
Yeah, I think if I was going to find an adjective, I would say fragility. That's a noun, isn't it? Fragile is an adjective. Just checking. You know, a sense of fragility is something I'm aware of, that many of the foundation stones which we thought were pretty well a feature of the 21st century, and that therefore we could build on and rest reasonably secure, have suddenly turned out to appear to be much more fragile than we used to think.
Yes. I think you saw that with the kind of, particularly the widespread shock when the Ukraine war started, for example, this sense, and I had this sense that, you know, conventional wars in Europe, you know, with tanks and missiles and aeroplanes and, you know, a whole mass conscription on both sides, that was a feature of the 20th century, but we put that behind us. And conflict now normally takes place miles away, and it's normally against some insurgency force in some dusty desert. And it doesn't really strike people like me living comfortable 21st century lives. And I think a lot of people had that sense of like, oh my gosh, you know, this war, you know, people are being bombed out of their apartments. They're wearing the same clothes as me. They have their smartphones and their laptops, and they go and drink coffee in cafes. And it's so close. And yet we thought this was something that had been put behind us.
That's right. And what's more, sort of incredible moral dilemmas of war. You know, do I turn and run and save myself? Do I volunteer and potentially sacrifice myself or defend my country?
Yeah.
You know, and the, as you say, this suddenly is close to home. I think COVID again was the fragility of modern society. I can remember, you know, that experience which we all had when suddenly the skies were empty, the roads were empty, everything
the
that
shelves
we thought
were
was
empty.
Normal, the shelves were empty. Yeah, everything had stopped. And was this possible? I mean, how could this be?
How could our ultra-sophisticated late capitalist order be so upturned by an invisible virus no one had ever heard of a year earlier? And we were kind of, you know, imprisoned in our own homes and, you know, desperately waiting for a miracle jab to kind of save us. And the sense in which as well that the politicians and our leaders were kind of floundering, that they weren't kind of like delivering the playbook of well-established, you know, industrialized nations. They were kind of saying, we don't know what to do. We're making up as we go along. And it became very obvious to us, the people, that they were making up as they went along.
I think that's right. And then this sort of distrust in experts, the populism, this is a very complex phenomenon, isn't it? But it's a very real phenomenon. And which we're seeing played out at the moment as we record this with President Trump in the States.
Yeah, and definitely, again, I think when I look back and study history of the 20th century, particularly post-war, you see there is this kind of white heat of technology. There's this hope that in a kind of technocratic age, we could manage things. And with our science and our skills and our knowledge and our high-tech universities, we can kind of shape the world and societies to be ever better. And that, I think, is gone. And people now just think these are kind of pointy egghead scientists are just kind of doing abstract things that have no relevance to my everyday life. Although, of course, the vaccines would be a strong counter-argument to that. But yeah, there's a sense in which, you know, why should I trust the experts? What are they? They don't know any more than we do about how to predict the future and manage these kind of roiling forces that are upheaving. And I think you can see that in political trends, you know, populist political parties winning power and gaining votes across the Western world. You see things like Brexit, you know, an explicit kind of repudiation of what the kind of chattering classes, the elites, political and economic elites thought was good for the country. And the people of Britain said, you know what you think isn't really working for us. We're going to throw it all up. We're going to disrupt. We're going to break it and see if we can build something better. And again, I would say the elections of Trump are an expression of that as well, a kind of disillusionment, dissatisfaction with conventional politics, whether of left or right, and saying, let's go for something maverick. What have I got to lose? This isn't working for me. So what have I got to lose with throwing it all up in the air and seeing what falls to pieces?
Yeah. And so this slogan, move fast and break things, was part of the Silicon Valley perspective. And it's interesting, isn't it, how, well, you can see that Elon Musk certainly operates on that.
Yes, trying to run a country like a startup.
But it's obviously got much more traction outside Silicon Valley. This seems to make sense to an awful lot of the population, as though, I mean, I've heard people say the implicit contract between rulers and the ruled, you know, we'll agree to be compliant population and trust you to run our lives, but the deal is that you will help us to improve our lives, our living standards. You will make sure that we have decent public services and so on. And there's an increasing sense amongst many in the population that that explicit contract, implicit contract, has been broken.
Yes. And I think actually the really significant roots of this actually go back to 2008 and the financial crisis and the kind of associated economic recession that we all lived through. And that had never really gone away. And when, you know, macroeconomists, when they look at the kind of, you zoom out on a multi-decade view, you can see that, yes, of course, there's ups and downs, but there's generally a sense in which from the end of the Second World War through till the early 2000s, there was this broad uptick in productivity, in GDP per capita, in all the other various measures. And then it kind of sputters to a halt. And particularly here in the UK, if real incomes have barely recovered when you adjust for inflation to what they were in 2008. So you've got an entire generation that's, you know, my generation, in fact, you know, I left school in 2008. I was looking for work and trying to build a career exclusively in a world in which, you know, salaries aren't going up, productivity is flatlining, growth is flatlining. And there's a sense in which, as you say, that we were all told that things gradually get better. And in the big picture, each generation is going to be wealthier and more prosperous than their parents. And that just objectively isn't the case. Your generation is significantly wealthier and more prosperous than mine, and probably will always be, because we're still living with the after effects of that economic crisis.
Yeah. And so I think that contributes to this mood of despair. I think also the fragility of what some people call the rules-based international order. I mean, again, you know, we thought that ever since the Second World War, there was this kind of global geopolitical rules-based order, which allowed stability, and everybody understood what the rules were and everybody kept them. And we thought that this law-based rules were fundamentally almost unchallengeable. And it suddenly turns out that they're far more fragile and open to just it being ignored and upturned than we ever thought.
Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't romanticize it because, of course, in all times in history, there's been a kind of law of the strong and rich, powerful countries take things that they want from weaker countries, even, you know, countries that ostensibly espouse the rules-based order. But certainly there was a sense, you're right, that more and more countries are kind of, you know, and I think particularly towards the end of the 20th century, there was a sense that more and more countries are kind of going democratic and kind of autocracies are being overthrown. And there is a sense that we're all, yeah, fair, share these fundamental values about the rule of law and democracy. And the end of the Cold War was obviously a big part of that, and the kind of flourishing of democracy in Eastern Europe and beyond as the Iron Curtain was torn down, and even hopes that, you know, Russia itself was kind of headed in that direction. And I remember as a younger person, people saying, you know, well, China, as China gets wealthier and starts to see the benefits of capitalism, of course, you know, with economic freedoms, political freedoms will inevitably follow. You know, it's inevitable that as the Chinese middle class will start demanding the right to vote and various other basic freedoms. And that's the path that China is on, which now, of course, feels wildly mistaken. But even a lot, again, there was a steady growth of the number of people living under some form of democratic government for much of the 20th century. And that has stalled, or in fact, possibly even gone into reverse in the last 10, 15 years. And again, the Ukraine war is an example. You know, great power politics are back. A richer, more powerful country wanted some territory owned by a neighbouring country, and so it just took it at the force of a gun. Again, something that we thought we'd left behind.
Yeah, and I think I've been reading a fascinating book called The Assault on the State, which traces this rise of authoritarian states. And it actually makes the argument it was Putin who really was the first successful modern dictator. He created a model which other people around the world have seen from afar of what the authors and others call the patrimonial state, where you have a single father figure and who runs the state, right, like a mafia boss who controls everything, who doles out favors, who demands complete loyalty, who becomes immensely rich, and who has a coterie of buddies, who controls every aspect of the state. And Putin demonstrated that it was possible. You have to be completely ruthless. You murder and exploit. But he showed it was possible. And that others across the world have noticed this, and strong men in many other states have now following the Putin playbook as to how to create a modern authoritarian, totalitarian regime. And if you look across the world at the number of people living in these totalitarian regimes, it's a remarkable percentage of the entire world population now. And again, who saw that coming 20 years ago?
Yeah. And countries that were previously deemed to be kind of secure democracies, backsliding, you know, I'm thinking of places like India, where Narendra Modi has kind of whittled away elements of the rule of law and is kind of replacing India's kind of pluralist secular paradigm with this kind of more hard-faced Hindu nationalism. Or Hungary, you know, a member of the European Union, you know, where Viktor Orban again has turned it into a kind of illiberal democracy.
Turkey would be another example.
Turkey is another great, excellent example of the same thing. And then you see, even in countries that retain democratic government, there is a rise of populism of left or right. And in many ways, a lot of people draw comparisons with the era in the 1920s and 30s, where there was a kind of crisis of democracy because it felt like the vigor and the strength and the vitality was with fascist countries, which dispensed with the need for these elections and popular consent and the rule of law. And they were the ones who were modernizing and industrializing and winning wars. And I think you have that sense where people feel like the existing constitutional politicians and leaders and parties are kind of increasingly aged and decrepit and feeble, and their parties are divided and unable to achieve anything. And that's why people, you know, in the UK, they're looking to reform and Nigel Farage. You know, in America, they look to someone like Trump. You know, in France, it would be Marine Le Pen and the National Front. In Germany, it's the AfD. It's these kind of populist parties who say, you know what, these namby-pamby wet liberals, they can't get anything done. They don't know how to solve our problems. The solution's going to be something a bit more radical. And again, 100 years ago, that was a quite compelling proposition. And lots of, you know, lots of the fascist parties that ended up sparking World War II were ultimately quite popular because they were replacing discredited, disillusioned democracies where people were genuinely unable to deal with crises and problems and were just kind of split and squabbling and failed.
So it's the attraction of the strong man, isn't it? That in frightening times, that's why this description of a patrimonial state, apparently it goes back to Weber, famous sociologist, is a father figure. What we need is a father figure. You know, we see these politicians squabbling amongst themselves, unable to agree. You know, we see the logjam in Parliament and important decisions being constantly fudged and deferred. What we need is a father figure, a father of the nation, who is going to lead us into the promised land. And it has an attraction. You can see, again, it just come back to this word fragile. Democracy is more fragile. Feels much more fragile than it ever did. In fact, interestingly, in this book, The Assault on the State, they also argue that Boris Johnson was an example of somebody who was prepared to ride roughshod through the rules, who built a cult of personality. What's fascinating about the UK is that in the post-Johnson era, we've actually gone back. Haven't we? The bureaucracy,
the ultimate managerial blandness,
the managerial state reasserts itself. So interestingly, the UK system was strong enough to withstand an assault from Boris, like and the time he prorogued Parliament, didn't he? He prorogued Parliament on a whim, and the Supreme Court said, "No, sorry, you're not
Parliament's
allowed
to reopen." Yes, and fundamentally, he backed down and conceded that one. And ultimately, he was ejected from office, not by the electorate, but by his own MPs, who revolted against him en masse. And again, that's a feature of British parliamentary democracy that's quite commonplace. It's how Margaret Thatcher met her end. It's how Tony Blair was ultimately forced out of power. It's quite common.
The palace coup. Then they call it the men in grey suits.
The men in grey suits come and tap on the shoulder and say, you know, hand you a revolver and a glass of whiskey, metaphorically speaking, and say, it's time to go, sir. And and it demonstrates where power really lies in the system is with the party apparatchiks, perhaps, rather than the executive. And it's not something you've seen in America, for example, where the Republican Party has become totally cowed and submissive to Trump. And it is a genuine impossibility to imagine his own party forcibly ejecting him from office, no matter what he did. But I think what is interesting to me is you have all these cultural forces we've talked about, the economic stuff, the politics, the pandemic, the war, but all of it flows downstream into culture. And people often say, you know, Gen Z, the people who have grown up in this, even more than millennials, my own generation, are in many ways a culture that's kind of deeply lost in a bit of ennui and despair and hopelessness. You know, and I've been, you know, you can find stats quite easily online, you know, percentages of people who feel that not only they, but their own children will also be poorer and worse off. They don't feel they have a future. And we talked about some of this when we did an episode about antinatalism and people kind of declining to have children, because what's the point? I think we live in an era in which people are just profoundly pessimistic about the future.
Well, if you add in climate change into this toxic mix, which I think particularly for Gen Z is one of the defining features, it's just the icing on the cake, isn't it, to this other long list of all these other problems. You just add in, oh, and by the way, we're destroying the planet and we're all going to burn, you know, it will be unlivable in a few decades. You know, that is just, again, and I suspect that's part of the reason why climate doom is actually attractive in a pessimistic age. It almost has this sort of fatalistic attraction, we're all doomed, you know, and it seems almost naive to say, oh no, we can solve this problem and there are mitigation factors and we're going to find ways of
well there's a bizarre appeal about being the kind of clear-eyed, gimlet-faced kind of, you know, there is no hope. Wake up, sheeple, you know, like we're all doomed. Eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. I think paradoxically that actually is quite appealing to some people, even if deep down, obviously, everyone actually would like to have a future. But yes, I think certainly there is this wide cultural sense, and it increases as you go down, you know, the younger you get, that, you know, this year has been a hard year, to quote, but the next year will be harder. and that things aren't getting better, things are actually going the other direction. And yet what is so striking about this is that it's such an incredible shift from just 20, 30 years ago, a surge of cultural optimism and positivity, isn't it?
Yeah, before we get there, I just want to say the final doom is, of course, the AI doomers. And, you know, there are a significant percentage of the experts in Silicon Valley and elsewhere who who genuinely think that AI will destroy humanity and destroy the world. And these are the people who are making the machines. And
why are they doing it?
Well, exactly. And this is the interesting thing. So they've done surveys amongst, you know, AI experts of what is the probability that AI will destroy all human life. And this is called the P doom, you know, the probability of human extinction as a result of AI. And it's amazing because it ranges from, you know, 50%. Some people say virtually 100%. You know, the average is about 10%. So 10%. That's the probability of a complete annihilation of the human race by a superintelligence, by the people building these machines, is 10%. I mean, if you were building a machine with a 10% chance of destroying the humanity, you know,
I would stop.
Would you really be doing this? And yeah, that's what.
But this reminds me of that famous scene in the film. I don't know if you've seen Oppenheimer, where they're about to do the first ever nuclear test. And they asked the scientists, the physicists who are building, this is in World War II, who are building the atomic bomb. And they're saying, just out of curiosity, what is the chance that igniting this device triggers a chain reaction which vaporizes the atmosphere and destroys all the universe as we know it? And Oppenheimer's like, oh, it's a virtual impossibility. And he's saying, could you just clarify that? We are talking about something that would literally destroy all created beings. Is it a 1%? Is it 0.1%? And they actually went away and run the maths, and they figured it was 1 in 3 million chance is what their probability, their model suggested. And the American government decided they were happy to take the risk, and they went ahead with the nuclear test. Right.
No, it was a genuine fear, because the whole thing was about a chain reaction.
Yeah.
And the whole problem with a chain reaction is how it stopped.
How do you stop a chain reaction?
It just goes on and on and on and on and on. And people did the maths, as you say. And there was a realistic possibility that the chain reaction would not stop until every single molecule on the planet was involved.
Yeah. Just an alarming prospect.
It turned out that it did stop. It did stop. But anyway.
Yeah. So, but anyway, when something has an existential risk, you're more comfortable with 1 in 3 million than you are in 1 in 10, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. That's right. So anyway, this just adds to the... to the sense of doom. And it is fascinating to me, having lived through, you know, 4, 3 score years and 10 on this here planet, how I've seen these fluctuations in the mood. You know, the post-war, I was born in the immediate post-war era, when we still had rationing and there were bomb sites we used to play in. And there was a sense of the horror of war and the horror of technology. And then in the 60s, there was rising concerns about pollution. The effect of DDT, which was an insecticide that had been widely used in Africa, seemed to be having massive destructive effects. And huge worries about population explosion. Basically, again, we've talked about this before. It was going to wipe out the planet with too many mouths. And so it was...
And the kind of nuclear fatalism, right? With the bomb hanging over your heads and having to do drills in schools about what would happen if the Russians did a surprise attack.
Well, that was particularly 1980s, and that was Reagan and Star Wars. Reagan was deliberately notching up the international tension on nuclear. And... at the time, there was a genuine expectation of the nuclear holocaust was really quite likely. The government released public information films about surviving the bomb. I remember studying the medical consequences of nuclear war. It was horrific, having sleepless nights, imagining what it would be like as a very realistic possibility. But then you get the turn of the century and something seems to snap into suddenly it's a wonderful new world and a new optimistic world. Mm-hmm. And technology is going to solve the problems. Whatever the human race creates, technology is going to solve it.
And I think a lot of that is connected to the end of the Cold War, you know, the fall, the collapse of the Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall, and, you know, freedom, peace coming to Europe finally after World War II and the long 40 years of Cold War. And you have philosophers, famously a philosopher called Francis Fukuyama wrote a book about what he called the end of history and the idea that, you know, the 20th century was a battle of ideas between Western liberal democracy and capitalism and Eastern autocracy and communism. And the West won a sweeping, overwhelming victory. And everyone now agreed, everyone was on the same page that democracy and the liberal-based rules order and constitutional capitalist government was the best way forward. And we were going to live, you know, he was more complicated than this, but it's crudely caricatured that, you know, history had come to an end and we were just going to live in this perpetual era of peace. And but there was genuine optimism. I mean, I was a child, but, you know, there was the peace dividend. You know, we could finally spend some of the money we'd spent maintaining, you know, hair trigger up forces to deter a Russian attack could be reinvested in social programs. There was the idea that we would start decommissioning some of our nuclear weapons. And the internet was growing at the exact moment. The World Wide Web has been invented. You know, people are getting online and suddenly realizing the possibilities of this incredible new technology.
No, that's absolutely right. And also there were breakthroughs, the human genome, the first.
Yes, led by Francis Collins, genome, we had on this podcast a few months ago.
And that was hailed as a new beginning in which we finally take control over our own humanity. Hmm. So, times of enormous optimism. Then there was, of course, 9/11. And then it was the war against terrorism, wasn't it, that became a dominant factor.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, the Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now, let's get back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I guess what we're reflecting on is that there is a sense of cycles or even kind of whiplashes in which culture can move quite quickly from widespread consensus that, you know, things are bad, next year will be worse, we live in a time of despair and doom and ennui, to suddenly things are getting better and next year will be even better and we're developing and growing and we've kind of whipsawed between these two ends of the spectrum, even in, you know, something as relatively short as your own lifetime, Dad.
That's right. And to come down to land, I think there is, for this multitude of reasons, something about 2025 feels an astonishing time of fragility and also almost apocalyptic, to use that phrase. That and it's a word which people are using, aren't they? That as we look to the future, could this be the end of the West in its as it's been certainly since the Second World War, and what will be the consequences? And inevitably, a kind of speculation about the end times emerges, as it has so often in the past.
Definitely. And you think people are more interested than, you know, in times of comfort and peace and prosperity, people don't really want to think about the end times and how things go and what happens after they die and how do societies collapse. But at times of crisis, there's always a surge in interest in kind of millenarianism and apocalypticism. And, there's even, some historians have traced, the emergence of kind of specifically kind of millenarian cults and kind of new religious sects often explode during times of war or economic crisis.
That's right. I've been reading up a bit on this. I'm trying to write a book at the moment on AI and trying to look at the roots of technological developments and particularly techno-optimism. And the fascinating thing is that this techno-optimism can be traced back really to the medieval period and to it was Christians, often Christians on the fringe of orthodoxy, who were driving a millenarian speculation. But there's that Jesus was coming again, and in particular there was this belief of that a 1,000-year rule was going to be inaugurated based on the reading of Revelation. And there was related to the growth of knowledge and in technology. And many people had concluded that by studying the book of Daniel in detail, you would be able to calculate when the end times were. Isaac Newton apparently spent a great deal of time trying to calculate exactly from the book of Daniel. They calculated that there were 3.5 years of days, which turned out to be 1,260 years after the fall of the Roman Empire. But the question is, when exactly did the Roman Empire fall when did the 1,260 years start? And Isaac Newton spent a lot of time trying to work that. But apparently there's a verse in Daniel chapter 12, verse 4, where it says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase." And for people living in the 16th and 17th century, with the voyages of global exploration and the startling increase of knowledge and science, they said, this is it. This is what was predicted in the book of Daniel, and we're about to see the millennium. Mm. And many people, that trend, carried on. Francis Bacon was one of the very important figures in all this.
And if you look at church history, you can find in basically every time since, Christians proclaiming that they are convinced from studying the Bible and the evidence, reading the signs of the times, that these are the last days. That is a kind of very, very consistent theme, but particularly is strong, I think, in certain more kind of reformed circles, and kind of you see that among some of the kind of Puritan and new religious movements that emerge post-Reformation in Europe, and also around the time of the English Civil War in the 1600s, there's lots of kind of millenarian apocalyptic Christian movements. And some of those ended up migrating across the Atlantic and helping to found various parts of what is now the USA.
Yeah, so that's one of the fascinating things that emerges, is that this was dominant in Europe, this kind of speculation. But it definitely crosses the Atlantic and becomes a very significant feature in America. And you could trace that all the way up to the present day, can't you? This, in many Christian fundamentalist groups and sects, this belief that there's something special about America. America has a special place in God's plans for the future.
Yes, American exception, American theological exceptionalism is certainly a theme. And I think even in more mainstream churches, which wouldn't kind of teach it from the pulpit, there is a kind of lingering beneath the surface sense that America is a special country, that God has got a plan, that America somehow features in the kind of salvation history of the universe. And, you know, I think maybe unchallenged by kind of pastors, this idea that, yeah, something about this establishment of the US and the founding fathers were kind of divinely inspired, and that there is some kind of role for America to play. And that feeds over into individual American Christians being very interested in trying to figure out, you know, when is the end times and what role do I have to play?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I found that Jonathan Edwards, very well-known Christian preacher, theologian in America, back in 1700s, he was saying that this new world is now discovered, the new and most glorious state of God's church on earth, that God might begin in a new world when he creates the new heavens and the new earth. And he was talking about the new world being America as the place where God, he was speculating about it. And this strange blend of techno-optimism, so that it's both on the one hand, God is going to do this, God is going to create the new world here. He's going to bring in the millennium. But at the same time, our inventions, our creations are part of the way in which we overcome the consequences of the fall. And we usher in the new age. So there's a religious, a Christian element to this techno-optimism.
And so what are we saying that Christians are right to be interested in discerning the end times, that this kind of despair and hopelessness and fatalism and nihilism is actually kind of pointing to a deeper truth?
Well, I think, yes. I think, as you said right at the beginning, Jesus says to us that we should be reading the signs of the times. And I think in general, in the evangelical Christian tradition, particularly in the UK, if anything, we err on the other extent. There's too little interest, seems to me, in trying to understand the times. It's often as though we're quite happy to be in our little bubble singing the songs of Zion and let the world do whatever it wants. And that doesn't seem to match with this call that Jesus gives us to be watchful and to be understand and be looking out for the signs of what God is doing in our current age.
And yet at the same time, we have to hold that intention with what Jesus also says about the fact that nobody knows when the end will really come. And, you know, therefore, you know, I'm afraid Isaac Newton wasted his time trying to come up with some incredibly complicated formula of multiplying years by certain things. You know, Christians have done this for time immemorial, gone to Daniel and the book of Revelation and tried to decipher some of those prophecies and turn it into real numbers. And it always ends up becoming this massive kind of rabbit hole that goes nowhere. And I would argue it ends up being a complete distraction from the actual task of Christian living and discipleship and living well.
Well, I think you're confusing two different things or conflating two different things there. I think there is the specific numerology of trying to calculate when Jesus is going to return. And I think that is, you're absolutely right, is a waste of time. And Jesus says specifically that it is a waste of time. And fascinatingly, he says that the Son doesn't even know. You know, which has caused a lot of theologians
head scratching,
on omniscience and so on. But we won't go into that just at the moment. But I think that, however, if you use numerology and the excesses of the past to say, therefore, there's no point in trying to understand what's happening in society, I think that's a massive mistake. And I think that seeing the big themes of what, so it seems to me that there are mini apocalypses as well as the final apocalypse. And interestingly, apocalypse basically means uncovering. It's a revelation. Apocalypses are an uncovering of what God's purposes are. And I think we are living in apocalyptic times. We seem to be entering apocalyptic times with a small a. I'm not claiming that necessarily this is the final apocalypse with a big A, but nonetheless, apocalyptic times are times of unsettling, shaking, but also potentially uncovering of new truth, new perspectives, new priorities.
That's interesting. So we need to understand apocalyptic to be more, as you say, small a kind of descriptive, rather than being focused on trying to figure out when the capital A, the last final apocalypse and Jesus's return is. We actually need to understand the signs of the times to say, actually, are we living through a time of revealing and uncovering, a time of harrowing and purging, cleansing, revealing, whatever adjective you want to use. And then also then, I guess, therefore, the next question is, what is being uncovered? What are we supposed to be attending to? What do we read when we read the signs of the times? What are we learning about ourselves or about our world or about God through this small a apocalyptic era?
Yeah, and those are good questions and no simple answers. I would say if you take the big picture of the book of Revelation, it's again the apocalypse to John, what you see is, above all, the rule of God and Christ over everything, that everything is controlled, our sense of fragility. You know, what the Bible is reassuring us, you may feel as though everything is crumbling under your feet. That's perfectly understandable, but you need a new vision of, in Revelation, it's the picture of the throne room, isn't it? Of he who is seated on the throne, and the Lamb, who are the ones who are in ultimate control, and nothing can shake the throne. Nothing can shake the throne room, even the sea, which is the ultimate symbol of unrest, is turned into glass. It cannot shake.
Yeah,
it cannot shake the throne. And yet, on earth, there are extraordinary powers, and behind it all in Revelation is the dragon, or the serpent, the picture of the evil one. But then there's the beast, who is in Revelation particularly reflects the Roman Empire and the power of the state. I mean, we were talking about patrimonial states. Well, there's the Roman Empire with immense military power.
And the emperor himself explicitly setting himself up as a kind of
as a god,
quasi divine figure.
So the power of the state is enormous, and then you've got this interesting other. You've got Rome depicted as a harlot who is seductive. Apparently, I didn't know this until recently, that many temples in a very syncretistic religion in the Middle East at the time had lots of gods, but the temples would always include an idol who was of this beautiful female, Roma, who epitomized Rome, the goddess who was behind the bounty of Rome. And so the harlot is portrayed, is clearly a reference to Rome, this Roma, this goddess, but now she's depicted not as an attractive, beautiful woman, but as this seductive harlot who intoxicates the nations, who with her beauty, but who is clearly seductive and lying in wait to entrap.
And the call on the church is to be the kind of faithful remnant that is not distracted and dragged down and not tempted away from the path by the nations and the powers that be, and you know, alternative paths. But John is kind of writing about, you know, keep the faith and keep your eyes fixed on Christ, and don't be sucked in by the seduction of worldly power.
That's right. So if you say, so what are the, from the book of Revelation, what are the calling to Christians in apocalyptic times? And so, like in Revelation 13, it says, here is a call for patient endurance and the faith of the saints. And that's repeated in Revelation 14, patient endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. It also says this calls for wisdom, you know, that this is the understanding, the reading the signs of the times. And then later on, he says, blessed is the one who is on the alert and who keeps his clothing so that he may not go about naked and be exposed.
And there's echoes in that in what Jesus says in some of his slightly apocalyptic bits in the Gospels, you know, about, you know, keep a sword close to hand and be ready to flee. And a lot of this people interpret as being warnings about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which was coming a few decades after his death. But there may also be kind of hints about this idea about being, you know, living watchful, living wary, living ready, being fleet of foot and ready to for whatever, wherever culture is swerving and taking us.
I think that's right. I think elsewhere in Revelation, there's a huge emphasis on speaking the truth. So what the beast does and the false prophet is a tissue of lies, of falsehoods, of counterfeits. And Christians are called in apocalyptic times to speak the truth and to bear witness, even if, you know, bear witness is martyro, to be a martyr. Because that's where bearing witness may well take us in apocalyptic times.
And already had taken many thousands of Christians by the time John is writing Revelation, you know.
Indeed.
It was very real. Telling the truth to this godless, idolatrous empire of Rome, what came at a huge cost in the early centuries of the church.
And remaining clear-headed against the intoxicants, I think that, again, is a fascinating image, isn't it? That, I mean, so what are the intoxicants of the modern age, the things that just dull our senses, that become, that lose our ability to be clear-sighted and clear-headed?
Yeah, well, we could do a whole podcast on that, couldn't we? Social media would be one of those, I think. What you said earlier about kind of keeping your eyes on the throne room and seeing the bigger picture reminds me of a very interesting parallel apocalyptic passage in the book of Daniel, which is obviously written hundreds and hundreds of years before Revelation. But in the latter chapters, there's a lot of parallels where some of the prophecies are about kind of empires rising and falling. And there's this image he has of this giant statue, which has got kind of, you know, gold arms and silver calves and stone bits. I can't remember the details, but basically it's much interpreted, but it's kind of seen to be as this kind of image of like worldly empires and powers standing over and oppressing, you know, the people of God. And yet then this enormous boulder comes and shatters it and knocks it down. And the boulder is kind of the enduring purposes of God, and who, you know, the King of Kings, the Emperor of Emperors. And the idea that God's kingdom is unstoppable. It's like a gigantic stone rolling down the hill. Nothing you can do will stop it. And yes, there will be pretenders and there will be earthly kingdoms that will rise and earthly empires who will claim authority and sway. But ultimately, they will all be swept aside. And one day, as we see in Revelation, the great multitude will gather, behold the throne room, and every tongue, every ethnicity will gather and recognize Jesus as the true King of the cosmos. And there's something there, stepping out of the kind of popular imagery for Christians to not be swayed too much by the nihilism and the fatalism and the despair of our age. Pay attention to it, read the signs of the times, but don't be sucked into it, because we actually have, you know, whether Trump is in power or Biden, whether it's Keir Starmer or Prime Minister Nigel Farage, you know, whether Putin's on the march or not, ultimately we know the trajectory of the world, and it is heading towards King Jesus on the throne, the Lamb that was slain. Ruling over all things for all time and ushering in his kingdom of goodness and love and grace. And so Christians have to remain clear-headed and focused on that as the ultimate victory and triumph rather than whatever particular worldly empire is on the up right now.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think a sort of Christians would espouse a realism, but a hopeful realism.
Mm.
So we don't just close our eyes to what is going on. We recognise there are very real threats. We recognise there could be catastrophe in our lifetime.
Yeah.
There could be World War III. There could be existential doom from lots of different places. But we are hopeful because we believe in a God who is greater than all this. And even more that this is actually just another part of the drama. There is a huge drama underway, which started from before the foundation of the world.
Hmm.
And it will go all the way to the ages of the ages in the biblical term. And we have a part to play as bit players. And we happen to be in this part of the drama. And exactly what the next act is going to be, we don't know, but we are called to play our part and to play it well.
Yes. Yeah. And there's an opportunity for the church, as it plays that part, to be quite countercultural. I mean, we talked about this a little bit in the episode about childlessness and kind of falling birth rates. But in an era in which people are quite commonly full of despair and hopelessness about the future, Christians kind of realistically but stubbornly holding on to hope and trying to model and live out a way that says, actually, we do believe there is a good God on the throne, despite all the ways the world is falling apart. We're not blind to that. We're not naive, but actually we are going to continue to live out hope. And that means we're going to carry on having children and building things and looking forward to the future, because we do believe in a hope that transcends the kind of negativities of the age. There was a famous essay, I don't know if you've ever read it, written by the writer C.S. Lewis in the 20th century, first published in 1948. So just a few years after the end of World War II, you know, the truth about the Holocaust was coming out. The echoes of Nagasaki and Hiroshima were still reverberating. And he wrote an essay called On Living in an Atomic Age. And it's kind of addressing people who were, again, feeling at that point, it was a period of despair and hopelessness. The idea that people were kind of just absolutely shocked, the idea that science had given mankind this weapon that could wipe out entire civilizations from a single bomb. And you know, it's a long essay. It's worth reading. You can find it online for free. But the bit that I always think about is where he says this, the first point to be made and the first action to be taken is to pull ourselves together. If we are all going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, let that bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible and human things. Praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, and chatting to our friends over a pint. Not huddled together like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. They may break our bodies, but they need not dominate our minds. And I think there's a lot of, it's not explicitly Christian argument, but there's a lot of godly wisdom in that. Not to be naive, but saying, you know, if, when the existential threat comes, do Christians want to be swept up with the despair and the fatalism and the pessimism and the fears of the day, or actually living out their vocation and their calling that we've had since the Garden of Eden, in quiet, faithful, simple ways until the time is such that Jesus brings it all to a close.
That's right. So again, to return to these words of Jesus, keep watch, because you don't know on what day your Lord will come. You know, there's a picture of the steward left in charge of the house. You've got that wonderful book, haven't you, with it, which your daughter loves to. You, of course, surprise!
Surprise, yes. And it uses the parable of the servant to talk about Jesus' return in a way for kind of kids to understand. And it's, Jesus comes, and it's always Jesus and the Very Big Surprise, I think it's called. The thief in the night, you know, you do not know when he's returning. And yet what do the servants find out when the master returns is that he puts on the servants' clothes and starts to wait and serve on them. And there's this wonderful idea that, yes, there's uncertainty. We don't know when the end is coming. We don't know if it's going to be another pandemic, if it will be nuclear war, if it will be climate change, if it will be unlikely, but it will be a super intelligent singularity caused by AI. But what we do know is that when the end comes, the person who is going to be drawing things to a close is our Lord and Savior Jesus, and he's a good God. And he comes to serve, not to dominate and destroy. And so however things do wrap themselves up, our call is to be watchful, to be ready. And the story ends with saying, you know, and here are the things you do while you can be ready. You know, love your friends, look out for the needy, go to church, pray, tell people about Jesus. Like, actually living in a watchful life of readiness should look a lot like living an ordinary life of Christian faithfulness.
Yeah, and instead of cowering in fear and what the future might bring, actually looking forward with anticipation to the apocalypse, to the revealing, because what we can be sure is that the apocalypse is going to reveal a new reality, new aspects of God and his love and faithfulness, which we have no idea, no concept.
No. Well, that seems like a good place to end. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope it wasn't too pessimistic an episode. We'd love to know your thoughts or anything that you've spotted on the internet that you think could kind of feed into these conversations in the future, or any ideas for something completely different we should be talking about on the podcast. So please do get in touch. You can email us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. You can also find lots of resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Lots of things to listen to and read and watch. And you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And I would particularly point you towards my weekly Critical Friend Substack newsletter on church news, which you can sign up to for free. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.